Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
As I look at the calendar, it claims to be October 2011, which is funny, because all around us, people are worried about banks. There are bailouts in the offing. Are we sure it's not October 2008? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Ally Bank, offering IRA savings products and a Raise Your Rate four-year CD. Learn more at allybank.com. Entrepreneurship Reporting is supported by Deluxe Corp, a marketing resource to 4 million small businesses with logo and website design, search engine marketing, and more at deluxe.com/marketing.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Wednesday. It is the fifth day of October 2011. Yesterday, France and Belgium moved to bail out one of the biggest banks in Europe, Dexia, a bank that had previously survived a financial stress test. It was considered healthy, but apparently that test just wasn't tough enough. And there are likely more Dexias in the wings. What is going on here? I'm joined by our New York Bureau Chief, Heidi Moore. Hi, Heidi.
Hi.
So Dexia is this Belgian bank. Europe bailed it out once already. Why do we care?
Dexia does play a big role in municipal bonds. So when cities here in the U.S. try to raise money, Dexia helps guarantee that debt. It helps make sure that they can actually get the money that they want. And the other problem is that there are a lot of banks in the same situation as Dexia. They hold a lot of debt from Greece, Italy, these countries that Europe derisively calls pigs. Portugal, Ireland, Italy, Greece, and Spain. And so you can tell what they think of them, right?
Right, right. Not flattering in any way, shape, or form.
And we're probably going to see a lot more of this.
Well, let me ask you this then. Why would so many banks want this debt?
It's government debt. Like when you have treasuries in your portfolio, that's zero risk. It's as good as cash, right? And so all the regulators said that this was zero risk debt. Hmm. And it's kind of like when you go shopping for drinks, right?
Okay.
Right. So alcohol, you know, is kind of bad for you. You know to avoid it.
Right.
Caffeine isn't too great, and you want to have that in moderation, too. But you can have all the water you want and not just be safe, but be healthy. And that's what banks thought, too. Hmm. These government bonds were like water to them. They were safe. They were healthy. They were pure. They were neutral. And I talked to Doug Elliott. He's a former J.P. Morgan executive who's now at the Brookings Institution. And he explained why the banks piled up this debt.
European banks loaded up too much on debt from the weaker countries. If you've got something that you're allowed to treat as risk-free, why wouldn't you just pile up this stuff?
So then why didn't we test the water, you know, to see if it was going to make the banks sick? And the water here is government bonds, right?
Right, exactly. And we were afraid of the answer, basically. So the tests were cautious. They didn't want to say what happens if Greece defaults and we have a massive panic, because they thought if we say that, it's going to happen. It's like saying Beetlejuice three times, right? If you remember that old movie from the 80s. Right. If you say banking crisis, banking crisis, banking crisis,
there's going to be a banking crisis.
Exactly. Yeah. And so they were afraid to test for something so extreme. And now, obviously, we're seeing the flaw in that.
Well, you know, as we mentioned up top, this feels a lot like 2008. We've got rumors. We've got signs of panic. It seems like there might be a contagion out there. Is this Redux?
It's Redux emotionally. But what's interesting here is that we actually know what we're dealing with here. If you think back at 2008, we had no idea what those mortgage securities were worth, who was holding them. Even the bank executives couldn't explain them. Now we know what the problem is. It is the debt of these troubled countries. And now we just need to know how to contain it and deal with it. So it's not so complicated. But what the two time periods do have in common is we have to drop this belief that some assets are risk-free. Do you remember those toxic mortgage securities?
Oh, yeah.
Who can forget them?
Yep.
They were rated AAA. They were as safe as U.S. Treasuries.
Jeez.
Like they had no risk at all. So if we learn anything, it has to be this. There is no such thing as perfectly safe lending.
Great. Oh, these are just lessons we continue to learn the hard way. Marketplace's Heidi Moore joining us from New York. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And I mentioned rumors. There is another bank that's been fighting them this side of the pond. Morgan Stanley is doing everything it can to reassure investors that its exposure to European banks is, contrary to rumor, not bigger than previously thought. But in this kind of environment, whispers take on a life of their own. Marketplace's Elisa Roth has more from New York.
The most obvious damage to Morgan Stanley so far has been its share price, which at one point this week was down 20%. It's come back since then, but people are still clearly worried about the bank. Brad Hintz follows financial institutions at Sanford Bernstein. He's also a former treasurer at Morgan Stanley. He says the rumors, which started with a post written under a pseudonym on a financial blog, unfairly single out Morgan Stanley.
Who has potential European risk? Anyone who's a major capital markets firm.
Hintz calculates Morgan Stanley has less than $2 billion of exposure to French banks. It's a fraction of the $39 billion cited by the blog. But as we saw with Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns, rumors can be dangerous. Charles Whitehead is a law professor at Cornell University.
Rumors that are circulated can become effectively self-fulfilling prophecies.
Whether they're true or not. Whitehead says if he were a risk manager doing business with Morgan Stanley,
what I might do is begin to cut my exposure to Morgan Stanley, and that might include not lending as much or lending at a higher cost or requiring more collateral, all of which will impact Morgan Stanley financially.
To make matters worse, the timing is terrible. Morgan Stanley just finished its quarter, which means it can't disclose any financial details until it reports earnings sometime in the next few weeks. On Monday, the CEO told employees to let outside analysts do their own analysis and let the facts speak. And yesterday, Morgan Stanley's biggest shareholder, a Japanese financial group, issued a statement of confidence in the bank. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Labor unions and consumer watchdogs are starting to lend their support to the growing Occupy Wall Street movement. At least 1,000 people crowded into New York's Foley Square this afternoon for a rally and march.
My name is Mike Nagy. I live in Paterson, New York. I work in Westchester. I'm a Verizon employee, a CWA 1103 member. Personally, I'd like to see some more responsible legislation passed on a federal level. Hopefully, make the corporations and the wealthy people pay their fair share of income tax and maybe give back to the society that has helped them come up to what they have.
One of the voices from the Occupy Wall Street rally in Manhattan today. We asked Marketplace's John Dimsdale to look at what might be next for the movement.
The Occupy Wall Street movement has yet to unite behind one set of demands. Braden King studies social movements at the Kellogg School of Management. He says the movement has to find leaders, create a structure, and identify villains.
Maybe it'll be a corporation or a set of corporations. You know, if they want to have an influence, they have to have something they're going after.
He says progressive organizations like Move On are already backing the movement. Today, AFL-CIO President Richard Trumka endorsed the protests as a powerful force for pressuring lawmakers to vote for job-creating legislation.
There's a groundswell happening. People across the country declaring that we are the 99% and we need a voice.
But Professor King says there's a risk in labor's embrace of the Occupy movement.
The danger for them that there's the tension between maintaining this grassroots capacity and that they've set up and then setting up objectives that are clear but that also allow them to be co-opted by bigger players.
More established progressives like Maryland Congresswoman Donna Edwards say labor's money and structure is important.
The increased attention and participation by organized movements are going to help them turn those concerns about the economy and their circumstance into real demands for the system.
It worked for the Tea Party, she says. Now it's the progressive movement's turn. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
It is tempting to play the stormy music today, given the rare October rain here in L.A., but that is not what happened on Wall Street. We'll have details when we do the numbers. So 3 years ago this month, we were in the deepest depths of the financial crisis. Banks teetered on the edge of insolvency. Pink slips littered corporate parking lots all over the country. You would be forgiven if you're getting a sense of deja vu these days. Commentator Robert Reich says there is a way to make the economy strong again, but it requires the folks in charge to actually do something.
Seems like only yesterday, conservative nabobs of negativity predicted America's ballooning budget deficit would generate soaring inflation and crippling costs of additional federal borrowing. Remember Standard & Poor's downgrade of the United States? Recall the intense worry about investors' confidence in government bonds, America's IOUs? For the last several weeks, the yield on the benchmark 10-year Treasury has been below 2%. In other words, the Cassandras were all wrong. Treasury bonds are buoyant, more popular with global investors than just about ever. That means it's cheaper than just about ever for the United States to borrow money from the rest of the world. The reason is global investors desperately want the safety of dollars. Almost everywhere else on the globe is a riskier bet. Europe is in a debt crisis. Investors worry the contagion may spread to many developing nations. Japan remains in critical condition, and China's growth is slowing, which means commodity prices around the world are slipping. Put this flight to dollars together with two other pertinent facts. First, unemployment in America remains sky high. 14 million Americans are out of work, and 25 million are looking for full-time jobs. Meanwhile, our nation's infrastructure is crumbling. Our roads, bridges, water and sewer systems, public transit systems, ports, airports, and school buildings are desperately in need of repair. Years of deferred maintenance are taking a huge toll. Now, connect the dots. America's borrowing costs lower than they've been in anyone's memory, unemployment higher and more stubborn than at any time since the Great Depression, and our infrastructure in desperate need of repair. What does it add up to? Anyone with half a brain will see this is the ideal time to borrow money from the rest of the world to put Americans to work rebuilding the nation's infrastructure. So why isn't it happening? The apparent problem is too many in Washington seem to have less than half a brain.
Robert Reich was Secretary of Labor for President Clinton. His most recent book is called Aftershock, The Next Economy and America's Future. Next week, David Frum. Till then, send us your comments, marketplace.org, and click on Contact. So here's a bit of recent history on the environment. The White House blocked new smog standards until 2013. The Keystone Pipeline, an oil pipeline set to run through the Midwest to the Gulf, is making progress. House Republicans have legislation in the works to delay two more air quality regulations. And now the Wall Street Journal reports the EPA may ease up on pollution rules for power plants. The EPA responds that it is only making technical adjustments to clean air rules. But it was enough to get us wondering whether economic woes are changing the calculation for environmental rules. Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports.
When it comes to environmental regulation, the lackluster economy and dismal job market hasn't, shall we say, encouraged high-level intellectual debate.
Well, the label job-killing regulation on Capitol Hill has become cartoonish rhetoric.
John Walk is the clean air director at the Natural Resources Defense Council. He says job-killer is like yelling fire in a crowded room,
where it causes all other considerations to be set aside.
Playing the jobs card can keep people from talking about full costs and benefits of regulation, which, says Harvard Business School professor Robert Stavins, is a problem.
This is an area where, unfortunately, one has to curse both sides of the debate.
These aren't end of the economy as we know it job destroyers. They aren't miracle economic growth engines. All environmental regulations have pluses and minuses. And right now, economists say the cost-benefit calculation should include, but not be limited to, the economy.
The costs of these regulations are greater in challenging economic times like the current one.
Michael Greenstone is an economist at MIT.
Whether or not that causes the cost of those regulations to be larger than the benefits, I think depends on the exact case.
Sure, losing jobs when power plants close down sounds like a bad idea. But immediate job numbers aren't the only part of the calculation. Economists and environmentalists say proposals and regulations should be judged on all of their merits. Like with the rest of the economy, there's no easy answer. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
Coming up, an effort to make college affordable in the Lone Star State.
If they work very hard and they can complete a course in 6 or 7 weeks instead of 15, we can accelerate time to degree.
But first, let's do the numbers. News that the service sector grew last month gave a boost to stocks today. The Dow perked up 131 points, 1 2/10% to close at 10,939. The Nasdaq rose 55 points, about 2 1/3% to finish at 2460. And the S&P 500 added 20 points, 1 3/4% to end at 1144. U.S. financial shares were mostly higher today. Morgan Stanley beat back those negative rumors with a 3 1/3% gain. J.P. Morgan Chase deposited nearly 2%. Citigroup rose 1 1/3%. A Reuters report that Microsoft is thinking about making an offer for Yahoo sent shares of that web portal up 10%. Microsoft rose more than 2%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.89%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Best Buy for Business, with commercial-grade inventory and personal account managers helping you get ready for business. BestBuyForBusiness.com. By Allianz, managing more than $2 trillion in assets and providing investment solutions through its affiliated companies in the U.S., AllianzUSA.com. And by Constant Contact, combining email marketing and social media for more customers and more time back on the clock. Learn more at ConstantContact.com. Listen to the numbers on your own time. Download the new Marketplace Radio iPhone app for on-demand access to all of our radio programs right on your iPhone. Coming soon for the Android.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at the events for Thursday. The Senate Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee will vote on the nomination of Richard Cordray to head up the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. FBI Director Robert Mueller meets with the House Intelligence Committee to discuss terrorist threats. Also in Washington, D.C., Occupy Wall Street protesters plan to occupy Freedom Plaza at noon. I'm Megan Larson.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Hockey fans across the country are getting ready for the puck to drop on the 2011-2012 National Hockey League season, which starts tomorrow. Basketball fans may have hockey on the brain, too. Many are wondering if the National Basketball Association will follow NHL history with respect to their current labor struggles. 7 years ago, the NHL lost an entire season over a contract dispute, and the NBA faces a similar fate. The preseason is already gone, and the first part of the regular season is now in jeopardy. Liz Mullen covers labor for the Sports Business Journal and joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Remind us very briefly about the NHL labor dispute back in 2004-05 and why they eventually lost the season.
Well, the NHL in 2004 asked for a massive change to the economic system. Most importantly, they asked for a salary cap. Back then, the NHL had no salary cap. At that time, the league said it was losing hundreds of millions of dollars, and the percentage of revenues going to players was at about 70%. What happened in the end is the players were locked out for several months. They agreed to the salary cap that they said they would not agree to, and then they agreed to a number of concessions. The owners essentially were seen as the big winners in that negotiation.
All right, now catch us up on what's at issue right now for the NBA, the National Basketball Association. What are they debating over?
Right now you have a situation where the NBA is asking to reduce the players' percentage of revenues from 57% to 47%. The players agreed to reduce it to 53%. The owner said that is not enough, and right now we're at a stalemate, and it looks like we could lose games in the NBA.
So we're at an impasse over 6%?
6% of the revenues is where we are right now.
Now, one of the interesting aspects here is that there are six NBA owners who also own NHL teams, and some of them have said that they think it's worth the NBA sticking it out, even if it means the season. And their argument has been that, you know, that yes, they lost the NHL season, but the league has come out perfectly fine, and the agreement ended up being more owner-friendly. Would that potentially then work for the NBA owners and the league?
There's a split among the owners, is what people on the player side say. One of the big problems the NBA has is it has the least amount of revenue sharing of any league. And you have hardliners and you have doves in the NBA situation. The question is, if the NBA loses a season, will they really come out as popular as before?
Mm-hmm.
After the 1998-1999 NBA lockout, you saw a huge decrease in fan interest in the NBA. Whenever you lose a season, you risk alienating your fans.
You've covered labor for all the major sports. Do you have any sense of what might happen here with the NBA?
You know, I'll tell you something. I see sports writers make predictions, and I've said nobody can make predictions. It's sort of like a poker game in some ways. And David Stern doesn't know what the real will of the players are. On the other hand, are the owners, are there some owners who don't want to go through with this lockout scenario? Will they be willing to go up on the number? And nobody knows that answer. I think whenever you have a sport that's losing money, like the NBA is, you have more chance, a greater chance of losing regular season games.
Liz Mullen covers labor for the Sports Business Journal. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Tess.
The price of a college degree just keeps on rising at about double the rate of inflation. Student loans now outpace credit card debt, and the value of a degree is the subject of a national debate. Marketplace has been looking into various efforts to bring those costs down. Today we go to Texas, where Republican Governor Rick Perry has challenged education officials to create a $10,000 bachelor's degree. I'm not talking $10,000 a year, $10,000 total. Tuition, books, fees, everything. From our education desk at WYPR in Baltimore, Amy Scott reports.
The last time you could get a bachelor's degree for less than $10,000 at, say, UT San Antonio was more than 20 years ago. Today, it costs almost four times that, roughly $39,000 over 4 years for tuition, fees, and books, not counting financial aid. Raymond Paredes is commissioner of the Texas Higher Education Coordinating Board. He says for a lot of Texans, that's too much.
Over 50% of the students in Texas K through 12 schools are classified as being poor. We have to make sure that those students have the opportunity to go to college and get a degree.
The board plans to meet with university provosts and community college officials over the next several months to take on Governor Perry's $10,000 challenge. Some ideas on the table? Have students take most classes online or do 2 years of community college, then finish at a university. Schools could offer a stripped-down degree with fewer electives, or Paredes says, let students earn credits faster.
If they work very hard and they can complete a course in 6 or 7 weeks instead of 15, we can accelerate time to degree.
Chris Covo took the traditional path to a college degree. I met him at a Starbucks in Austin recently. He had just finished at Texas State University, San Marcos.
I was eligible for every grant in the book, every loan, as much assistance as you can get. Still came out with 30 grand of debt. Pretty scary.
Covo is among those pushing to make college more affordable as part of a group of young conservatives called America's Next Impact. He says he got his money's worth in school. He was student body president. He's now in grad school in London. But he says students who can't afford to take on so much debt need a cheaper option.
Are those students going to be getting the experience I got as student body president, student regent, you know, sitting in office hours with my teachers, speaking with them for, you know, hours about Socrates? Doubtful. But that doesn't mean they're not going to get what they need to be successful in a career of their choice.
But will they get what they need? Many educators think the whole Socrates thing is exactly what makes college so valuable. They doubt it's even possible to offer a high-quality degree for just a quarter of what it costs now.
In the final analysis, you get what you pay for. And if you pay $10,000 for a degree, that's what it's worth.
Peter Flan is president emeritus of the University of Texas flagship at Austin. He's part of a group that formed to fight Rick Perry's higher ed agenda. At the same time the state has gutted funding for universities, Perry wants them to be more productive, churning out more degrees for less money. Flan agrees something has to be done to make college more affordable.
But without sacrificing the quality of it, because a cheap degree is a cheap degree. And the people that hire college graduates know the difference.
Universities also know the difference. They stand to lose out on tuition if low-priced degrees take hold. A few community colleges in the state have come close to the $10,000 mark with a Bachelor of Applied Technology degree. Beth Hagen is with the Community College Baccalaureate Association. She says community colleges, known for two-year associate's degrees, are offering more career-focused bachelor's degrees in fields like nursing and energy management. She says employers love them.
Because they are applied degrees. They're not about history or English or, you know, some of the more traditional liberal arts subjects. They're about workforce-related programs.
Hagen doubts that a traditional research university, with all that goes on campus, could offer that same experience for as little as $10,000. But for students looking for a credential to get a job, she says there is an alternative. In Austin, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by MassMutual, offering business owners financial guidance for the long term. Information at massmutual.com. By reputation.com, helping small business owners, professionals, and executives monitor, protect, and improve their online reputations. Reputation.com. And by Putnam Investments, focused on finding opportunities one stock at a time. On the web at putnam.com/largecapequity. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
And this final note, more often than not, the debate over energy and the environment is framed as either or, oil and gas versus, say, wind and solar. Well, the oil giant Chevron is doing its part to bring the two worlds together. As you know, it takes energy to pull crude oil out of the earth. One common way is to burn natural gas to generate steam to heat up the oil for extraction. Well, Chevron has a new project that generates steam a different way, by using mirrors to reflect solar energy onto a boiler. Yes, they are using solar to get oil out of the ground and manufacturing a hefty dose of irony in the process. And that is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Today, the Dow perked up 131 points, 1 2/10%. The NASDAQ grew 55 points, about 2 1/3%. And the S&P 500 added 20 points, 1 3/4%. Vahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Bradford Craig, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the program for us. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report. Jeremy Hobson hosts Live from London, where he talks to reporters from Greece and Germany about how the crisis is affecting their perceptions of one another. Next time on this show, Kai rides a bus down Sunset Boulevard to find out how Angelenos feel about the economy and their futures.
Do I live check to check?
Yeah.
I do.
How long has it been like that?
Since I had my kids, since I started working.
I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.